Chapter 11. Tar Valon. The small village of Dairion had lain beside the river Arranon almost as long as Tar Valon had occupied its island. Dairion's small red and brown brick houses and shops, its stone-paved streets, gave a feel of permanence, but the village had been burned in the Trolloc Wars, sacked when Artur Hawkwing's armies besieged Tar Valon, looted more than once during the War of the Hundred Years, and put to the torch again in the Aiel War, not quite 20 years before. An unquiet history for a little village, but Dairion's place at the foot of one of the bridges leading out to Tar Valon ensured it would always be rebuilt, however many times it was destroyed, so long as Tar Valon stood, at least. At first it seemed to Egwene that Dairion was expecting war again. A square of pikemen marched along the streets, ranks and files bristling like a carding comb, followed by bowmen in flat, rimmed helmets, with filled quivers riding at their hips, and bows slanted across their chests. A squadron of armored horsemen, faces hidden behind the steel bars of their helmets, gave way to Verin and her party at a wave of their officers' gauntleted hand. All wore the white flame of Tar Valon, like a snowy teardrop on their breasts. Yet townspeople went about their business with apparent unconcern, the market throng dividing around the soldiers as if marching men were obstructions they were long used to. A few men and women carrying trays of fruit kept pace with the soldiers, trying to interest them in wrinkled apples and pears pulled from winter cellars. But aside from those few, shopkeepers and hawkers alike paid the soldiers no mind. Verin seemingly ignored them, too, as she led Egwene and the others through the village to the great bridge, arching over half a mile or more of water like lace woven from stone. At the foot of the bridge more soldiers stood guard, a dozen pikemen and half that many archers, checking everyone who wanted to cross. Their officer, a balding man with his helmet hanging on his sword hilt, looked harassed by the waiting line of people afoot and on horseback, people with carts drawn by oxen or horses or the owner. The line was only 100 paces long, but every time one was let onto the bridge, another joined the far end. Just the same, the balding man seemed to be taking his time about making sure each one had a right to enter Tar Valon before he let them go. He opened his mouth angrily when Verin led her party to the head of the line, then caught a good look at her face and hurriedly stuffed his helmet onto his head. No one who really knew them needed a great serpent ring to identify Aes Sedai.
"Good morrow to you, Aes Sedai," he said, bowing with a hand to his heart. "Good morrow. Go right across, if it please you."
Verin reined in beside him. A murmur rose from the waiting line, but no one voiced a complaint aloud.
"Trouble from the White Cloaks, guardsmen?
Why are we stopping?" Egwene wondered urgently. "Has she forgotten about Matt?"
"Not really, Aes Sedai," the officer said. "No fighting. They tried to move into Eldone Market, the other side of the river, but we showed them better. The Armorlin means to make sure they don't try again."
"Verin Sedai," Egwene began carefully. "Matt." "In a moment, child," the Aes Sedai said, sounding only halfway absent-minded. "I have not forgotten him." Her attention went right back to the officer.
"And the outlying villages?"
The man shrugged uncomfortably.
"We can't keep the White Cloaks out, Aes Sedai, but they move off when our patrols ride in. They seem to be trying to goad us."
Verin nodded and would have ridden on, but the officer spoke again.
"Pardon, Aes Sedai, but you've obviously come from a distance. Have you any news? Fresh rumors come upriver with every trading vessel. They say there's a new false dragon out west somewhere. Why, they even say he has Artur Hawkwing's armies back from the dead following him, and that he killed a lot of White Cloaks and destroyed a city. Falma, they call it. In Tarabon, some say."
"They say Aes Sedai helped him,"
a man's voice shouted from the waiting line. Hurin breathed deeply and shifted himself as if he expected violence. Egwene looked round, but there was no sign of whoever had shouted. Everyone appeared to be concerned only with waiting, patiently or impatiently, for his turn to cross. Things had changed, and not for the better. When she had left Tar Valon, any man who spoke against Aes Sedai would have been lucky to escape with a punch in the nose from whoever overheard. Red in the face, the officer was glaring down the line. Rumors are seldom true, Verin told him. I can tell you that Falma still stands. It isn't even in Tarabon, guardsman. Listen less to rumor and more to the Amarlin seat. The light shine on you. The bridge struck Egwene with wonder, as the bridges of Tar Valon always did. The openwork walls looked intricate enough to tax the best craftswoman at her lace frame. It hardly seemed that such could have been done with stone, or that it could stand even its own weight. The river rolled strong and steady 50 paces or more below, and for all that half mile the bridge flowed unsupported from river bank to island. Even more wondrous in its own way was the feeling that the bridge was taking her home. More wondrous and shocking. Emmons Field is my home. But it was in Tar Valon that she would learn what she must to keep her alive, to keep her free. It was in Tar Valon that she would learn, must learn, why her dreams disturbed her so, and why they sometimes seemed to have meanings she could not puzzle out. Tar Valon was where her life was tied now. If she ever returned to Emmons Field, the if hurt, but she had to be honest. If she returned, it would be to visit, to see her parents. She had already gone beyond being an innkeeper's daughter. Those bonds would not hold her again either, not because she hated them, but because she had outgrown them. The bridge was only the beginning. It arched straight to the walls that surrounded the island, high walls of gleaming white silver-streaked stone, whose tops looked down on the bridge's height. At intervals, guard towers interrupted the walls, of the same white stone, their massive footings washed by the river. But above the walls and beyond rose the true towers of Tar Valon, the towers of Story, pointed spires and flutes and spirals, some connected by airy bridges a good 100 paces or more above the ground, and still only the beginning. There were no guards on the bronze-clad gates, and they stood wide enough for 20 abreast to ride through, opening onto one of the broad avenues that crisscrossed the island. Spring might barely have come, but the air already smelled of flowers and perfumes and spices. The city took Egwene's breath as if she had never seen it before. Every square and street crossing had its fountain, or its monument or statue, some atop great columns as high as towers, but it was the city itself that dazzled the eye. What was plain in form might have so many ornaments and carvings that it seemed an ornament itself, or lacking decoration, used its form alone for grandeur. Great buildings and small, in stone of every color, looking like shells or waves or wind-sculpted cliffs, flowing and fanciful, captured from nature or the flights of men's minds. The dwellings, the inns, the very stables, even the most insignificant buildings in Tar Valon had been made for beauty. Ogier stonemasons had built most of the city in the long years after the breaking of the world, and they maintained it had been their finest work. Men and women of every nation thronged the streets. They were dark of skin and pale and everything in between, their garments in bright colors and patterns or drab, but decked with fringes and braids and shining buttons, or stark and severe, showing more skin than Egwene thought proper, or revealing nothing but eyes and fingertips. Sedan chairs and litters wove through the crowds, the trotting bearers crying, "Give way!" Closed carriages inched along, liveried coachmen shouting, "Hey-ya!" and "Ho!" as if they believed they might achieve more than a walk. Street musicians played flute or harp or pipes, sometimes accompanying a juggler or an acrobat, always with a cap set out for coins. Wandering hawkers cried their wares, and shopkeepers standing in front of their shops shouted the excellence of their goods. A hum filled the city like the song of a thing alive. Verin had pulled her cowl back up, hiding her face. No one seemed to be paying them any mind in these crowds, Egwene thought. Not even Matt in his horse litter drew a second glance, though some folk did edge away from it as they hurried past. People sometimes brought their sick to the White Tower for healing, and whatever he had might be catching. Egwene rode up beside Verin and leaned close. "Do you really expect trouble now? We are in the city. We are almost there." The White Tower stood in plain sight now, the great building gleaming broad and tall above the rooftops. "I always expect trouble," Verin replied placidly. and so should you, in the tower most of all. You must all of you be more careful than ever now. Your tricks, her mouth tightened for an instant before Serenity returned, frightened away the white cloaks, but inside the tower they may well bring you death or stilling.
I would not do that in the tower, Egwene protested. None of us would.
Nynaeve and Elaine had joined them, leaving Huron to mind the litter horses. They nodded, Elaine fervently, and Nynaeve, it seemed to Egwene, as if she had reservations.
You should not do it ever again, child. You must not. Ever.
Varen eyed them sideways round the edge of her cowl and shook her head.
And I truly hope you have learned the folly of speaking when you should be silent.
Elaine's face went crimson, and Egwene's cheeks grew hot.
Once we enter the tower grounds, hold your tongues and accept whatever happens. Whatever happens. You know nothing of what awaits us in the tower, and if you did, you would not know how to handle it, so be silent.
I will do as you say, Varen Sedai, Egwene said, and Elaine echoed her. Nynaeve sniffed. The Aes Sedai stared at her, and she nodded reluctantly. The street opened into a vast square centered in the city, and in the middle of the square stood the white tower, shining in the sun, rising until it seemed to touch the sky from a palace of domes and delicate spires and other shapes surrounded by the tower grounds. There were surprisingly few people in the square. No one intruded on the tower unless he had business there, Egwene reminded herself uneasily. Huron led the horse litter forward as they entered the square.
Varen Sedai, I must leave you now.
He eyed the tower once, then managed not to look at it again, though it was hard to look at anything else. Huron came from a land where Aes Sedai were respected, but it was one thing to respect them, and quite another to be surrounded by them.
You have been a great help on our journey, Huron, Varen told him, and a long journey it has been. There will be a place in the tower for you to rest before you travel on.
Huron shook his head emphatically.
I cannot waste a day, Varen Sedai. Not another hour. I must return to Shinar to tell King Izar and Lord Agelmar the truth of what happened at Falma. I must tell them about...
He cut off abruptly and looked around. There was no one close enough to overhear, but he still lowered his voice and said only,
about Rand, that the dragon is reborn. There must be trading ships heading upriver, and I mean to be on the next to sail.
Go in the light, then, Huron of Shinar, Varen said.
The light illumine all of you, he replied, gathering his reins.
Yet he hesitated a moment, then added,
If you need me, ever, send word to Faldara, and I'll find a way to come.
Clearing his throat as if embarrassed, he turned his horse and trotted away, heading beyond the tower. All too soon he was lost to sight. Nynaeve gave an exasperated shake of her head.
Men, they always say to send for them if you need them, but when you do need one, you need him right then.
No man can help where we are going now, Varen said dryly. Remember, be silent. Egwene felt a sense of loss with Huron's going. He would barely talk to any of them except Matt, and Varen was right. He was only a man, and helpless as a babe when it came to facing whatever might await them in the tower. Yet his leaving made their number one less, and she could never help thinking that a man with a sword was useful to have around. And he had been a link to Rand and Perrin.
I have my own troubles to worry about.
Rand and Perrin would have to make do with Moiraine to look after them.
And Min will certainly look after Rand, she thought with a flash of jealousy that she tried to suppress.
She almost succeeded. With a sigh, she took up the lead of the horse litter. Matt lay bundled to his chin. His breathing was a dry rasp.
Soon, she thought. You'll be healed soon now, and we'll find out what's waiting for us.
She wished Varen would stop trying to frighten them. She wished she did not think Varen had reason to frighten them. Varen took them around the tower grounds to a small side gate that stood open with two guards. Pausing, the Aes Sedai pushed back her cowl and leaned from her saddle to speak softly to one of the men. He gave a start, and a surprised look at Egwene and the others. With a quick, "As you command, Aes Sedai," he took off into the grounds at a run. Varen was already riding through the gates as he spoke. She rode as if there were no hurry. Egwene followed with the litter, exchanging glances with Nynaeve and Elaine, wondering what Varen had told the man. A gray stone guardhouse stood just inside the gate, shaped like a six-pointed star lying on its side. A small knot of guards lounged in the doorway. They left off talking and bowed as Varen rode past. This part of the tower grounds could have been some lord's park, with trees and pruned shrubs and wide graveled paths. Other buildings were visible through the trees, and the tower itself loomed over everything. The path led them to a stable yard among the trees, where grooms in leather vests came running to take their horses. At the Aes Sedai's direction, some of the grooms unfastened the litter and set it gently off to one side. As the horses were led away into the stable, Varen took the leather sack from Matt's feet and tucked it carelessly under one arm. Nynaeve paused in knuckling her back and frowned at the Aes Sedai. "You said he has hours, perhaps. Are you just going to—" Varen held up a hand, but whether it was the gesture that stopped Nynaeve or the crunch of feet approaching on gravel, Egwene could not say. In a moment Shiriam Sedai appeared, followed by three of the accepted, their white dresses ringed at the hem with the colors of all seven Ajahs from blue to red, and two husky men in rough laborers' coats. The mistress of novices was a slightly plump woman, with the high cheekbones that were common in Saldaea. Flame-red hair and clear, tilted green eyes made her smooth Aes Sedai features striking. She eyed Egwene and the others calmly, but her mouth was tight. "So you have brought back our three runaways, Varen. With everything that happened, I could almost wish you had not." "We did not," Egwene began, but Varen cut her off with a sharp, "Be silent!" Varen stared at her, at each of the three of them, as if the intensity of her look could hold their mouths shut. Egwene was sure that for her part it could. She had never seen Varen angry before. Nynaeve crossed her arms beneath her breasts and muttered under her breath, but she said nothing. The three accepted behind Shiriam kept their silence, of course, but Egwene thought she could see their ears grow from listening. When she was certain Egwene and the others would remain still, Varen turned back to Shiriam. "The boy must be taken somewhere away from everyone. He is ill, dangerously so. Dangerous to others as well as to himself. I was told you had a litter to be carried." Shiriam motioned the two men to the litter, spoke a quiet word to one, and as quickly as that, Matt was whisked away. Egwene opened her mouth to say he needed help now, but at Varen's stare, quick and furious, she closed it again. Nynaeve was tugging her braid nearly hard enough to pull it out of her head. "I suppose," Varen said, "that the whole tower knows we have returned by now?" "Those who do not know," Shiriam told her, "will know before much longer. Comings and goings have become the first topic of conversation and gossip, even before Falma and far ahead of the war in Cairhien. Did you think to keep it secret?" Varen gathered the leather sack in both arms. "I must see the Ammerlin immediately."
"And what of these three?"
Varen considered Egwene and her friends, frowning. "They must be closely held until the Ammerlin wishes to see them, if she does wish to. Closely held, mind. Their own rooms will do, I think. No need for cells. Not a word to anyone." Varen was still speaking to Shiriam, but Egwene knew the last had been meant as a reminder to her and the others. Nynaeve's brows were drawn down, and she jerked at her braid as if she wanted to hit something. Elaine's blue eyes were open wide, and her face was even paler than usual. Egwene was not sure which feelings she shared, anger or fear or worry. Some of all three, she thought. With a last searching glance at her three traveling companions, Varen hurried off, clutching the sack to her chest, cloak flapping behind her. Shiriam put her fists on her hips and studied Egwene and the other two. For a moment Egwene felt a lessening of tension. The mistress of novices always kept a steady temper and a sympathetic sense of humor, even when she was giving you extra chores for breaking the rules. But Shiriam's voice was grim when she spoke.
Not a word, Varen Sedai said, and not a word shall it be. If one of you speaks, except to answer an Aes Sedai, of course, I'll make you wish you had nothing but a switching and a few hours scrubbing floors to worry about. Do you understand me?
Yes, Aes Sedai, Egwene said, and heard the other two say the same, although Nynaeve pronounced the words like a challenge. Shiriam made a disgusted sound in her throat, almost a growl.
Fewer girls now come to the tower to be trained than once did, but they still come. Most leave, never having learned to sense the true source, much less touch it. A few learn enough not to harm themselves before they go. A bare handful can aspire to be raised to the accepted, and fewer still to wear the shawl. It is a hard life, a hard discipline. Yet every novice fights to hold on, to attain the ring and the shawl. Even when they are so afraid they cry themselves to sleep every night, they struggle to hold on. And you three, who have more ability born in you than I ever hope to see in my lifetime, left the tower without permission, ran away not even half-trained, like irresponsible children, stayed away for months. And now you ride back in as if nothing has happened, as if you can take up your training again on the morrow. She let out a long breath as if she might explode otherwise.
Faerlane!
The three accepted jumped as if they had been caught eavesdropping, and one, a dark, curly-haired woman, stepped forward. They were all young women, but still older than Nynaeve. Nynaeve's rapid acceptance had been extraordinary. In the normal course of things, it took years as a novice to earn the great serpent rings they wore, and it would take years more before they could hope to be raised to full Aes Sedai.
Take them to their rooms, Shiriam commanded, and keep them there. They may have bread, cold broth, and water until the Ammerlin seat says otherwise. And if one of them speaks even a word, you may take her to the kitchens and set her to scrubbing pots.
She whirled and stalked away, even her back expressing anger.
Faerlane eyed Egwene and the others with almost a hopeful air, especially Nynaeve, who wore a glower like a mask. Faerlane's round face held no love for those who broke the rules so extravagantly, and less for one like Nynaeve, a wilder who had earned her ring without ever being a novice, who had channeled power before she ever entered Tar Valon. When it became obvious that Nynaeve meant to keep her anger to herself, Faerlane shrugged.
When the Ammerlin sends for you, you'll probably be stilled.
Give over, Faerlane, another of the accepted said. The oldest of the three, she had a willowy neck and coppery skin, and a graceful way of moving.
I will take you, she told Nynaeve. I am called Theodrin, and I too am a wilder. I will hold you to Shiriam Sedai's order, but I will not bait you. Come.
Nynaeve gave Egwene and Elaine a worried look, then sighed and let Theodrin lead her away.
Wilders, Faerlane muttered. On her tongue it sounded like a curse. She turned her stare to Egwene.
The third accepted, a pretty, apple-cheeked young woman, stationed herself beside Elaine. Her mouth was turned up at the corners as if she liked to smile, but the stern look she gave Elaine said she would brook no nonsense now. Egwene returned Faerlane's stare with as much calm as she could manage, and, she hoped, a measure of the haughty, silent contempt that Elaine had adopted.
Red Aja, she thought, this one will definitely choose the reds. But it was hard not to think of her own troubles. Light, what are they going to do to us?
She meant the Aes Sedai, the tower, not these women.
Well, come along, Faerlane snapped. It's bad enough I have to stand guard on your door without standing here all day. Come along.
Taking a deep breath, Egwene gripped Elaine's hand and followed.
Light, let them be healing Matt.